no cost at all. We're going to dive into our study. It all belongs to God. We're talking about the story of God's people. God's people play a very important role in what he's doing in the world. And today, I got the privilege of talking about the divided kingdom. And you guys are all going, wow, the divided kingdom, we get to hear about that. That is so wonderful. Or not. But it is kind of cool. Open your Bibles, grab your notes. We're going to be talking a lot through 1 Kings and Samuel, a lot of that area, mostly 1 Kings. But I want to read 1 Kings 11, the first 13 verses, to kind of set the stage for what happens in the divided kingdom. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter: Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after other gods." Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. Don't they always? As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Asherah, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, "Since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." Victor Hamilton, in his book, A Handbook on the Historical Books, makes some very interesting observations about King Solomon. He says, Solomon is an amazingly paradoxical character. Here is somebody capable of both loving God and loving many foreign women who do not love his God, of exercising incredible wisdom and incredible stupidity, of accumulating a great number of proverbs and wise sayings. 1 Kings 4, 32 through 34 says that Solomon spoke 3,000 proverbs and his songs numbered 1,005. He described plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the walls. He also taught about animals and birds and reptiles and fish. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. He was a wise and well-studied man. But he also accumulated an impressive number of wives and concubines. As we just read in verse 3, he had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines. Hamilton goes on to say, Solomon is somebody who can wholeheartedly live by the teachings of one portion of Deuteronomy, but at another time fragrantly go against another portion of Deuteronomy. And then he says, perhaps Solomon is the original Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, throughout its history, the nation of Israel had its ups and downs. But shortly after Solomon's death, it literally breaks apart. It splits and begins a rapid decline. We read about that split in 1 Kings 12, 1 through 16. I wasn't going to read it, but I think it is worth reading. And young men, take a special note. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israelites had gone there to make him king. This is Solomon's son. Then Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this. He was still in Egypt where he had fled from King Solomon. He had rebelled and Solomon was after him, and so he took off, went to Egypt. Well, he returned from Egypt. So they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now listen, lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you. We will be your loyal subjects if you'll only lighten up." Rehoboam answered, "Go away for 3 days and then come back." So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. "How would you advise me to answer these people?" he asked. Now remember, he's talking to the elders of Israel. They replied, "If today you will be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always serve you. They will always be your servants." But Rehoboam rejected that advice. You know, there's something about being king that is intoxicating. I don't want to be a servant. I want to be the boss. He rejected the advice the elders that gave him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him and were serving him. He asked them, "What's your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, 'Lighten the yoke of your father put on us'?" The young men who had grown up with him, all pooling their ignorance, said, "Tell these people who have said to you, 'Your father put a heavy yoke on us, make our yoke lighter.' Tell them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I'll make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I'll scourge you with scorpions.'" 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam, as the king had said, "Come back to me in 3 days." The king answered the people harshly, rejecting the advice given him by the elders. He followed the advice of the young men and said, "My father made you your yoke heavy. I'll make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I'll scourge you with scorpions." So the king did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from the Lord to fulfill the word he had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah the Shilohite. When all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to him, they answered the king, "What share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel. Look after your own house, O David." In other words, they're gone. They split. No more. Now, the northern kingdom, that gives us the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom throughout the scriptures is called Israel, and it consists of 10 tribes that went with Jeroboam. He was a subordinate of Solomon's. He was not related. He was not one of his sons. The southern kingdom throughout the scriptures is called Judah, and it consists of 2 tribes, the tribe of Judah and Benjamin. They stay with Rehoboam and with the house of David. It's important that you remember those distinctions between Israel and Judah, because that's what you'll see many times throughout the rest of the scriptures, and you got to pay attention to which kingdom they're talking about. Jeroboam is the first king of the northern kingdom, which lasts about 250 years. In 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 34 through 38, God makes a pretty good promise to him. Listen to what he says. Let me put the reference up there. "But I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David my servant, whom I chose and who observed my commandments and statutes." Now listen to what God is going to do with the repeated, "I will, I will." "I will take the kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. I will give one tribe to his son, so that my servant, David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem." That's an important thing we'll come back to later. "The city where I chose to put my name. However, as for you, I will take you, and you will rule all over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel." And here's the key: "If you do whatever I command you and walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and commands, as David my servant did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David, and I will give Israel to you. But look at his response to this promise. Then Jeroboam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. From there he went out and built up Peniel. Jeroboam thought to himself, the kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David if the people go up and offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem. Then they will give their allegiance once again to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They'll kill me and return to Rehoboam. So he's saying, you know, if they actually go to church where God told them to and go to Jerusalem and do the prescribed worship the way God had laid it out, man, that's gonna be the death knell to me. They'll switch their allegiance to the bad guys. And so after seeking advice, the king made two golden calves. And he said to people, it's too much for you to go all the way up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. And so he set one up in Bethel and the other in Dan, one end of the kingdom to the other. And this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there. Jeroboam built shrines on the high places, appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. This he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he made. And at Bethel, he also installed high priests at the high places he had made. On the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing, he offered sacrifices on the altar he had built at Bethel. So he instituted a festival for the Israelites and went up to the altar to make offerings. Now it's interesting. The northern kingdom has 19 kings, and none of them trace their ancestry back to David, and they never establish a single dynasty like God had promised. They only have a series of what we might call mini dynasties that only last a short time, because, as Hamilton says, he tinkered with how and where God is to be worshipped, and really with the fundamental concept of who God is. See, here's what happens. We talked about this in Genesis, and we're going to review that again. But remember, Satan is offering Adam and Eve a kingdom, essentially. And in Adam and Eve's fall, he sets up this counter kingdom. He wants to rule the earth. And you see it here in God's people. God is working through this special people, this nation, and he sets up a counter to that. He sets up a counter kingdom that will run parallel and threaten the real kingdom from which the seed of the woman is going to come. And he sets up a counterfeit religion. Now, it wasn't some pagan idolatry like the Asherah or Baal or anything like that. I think it was the worship of Jehovah, the God of Israel, but on their terms. And in the experiences and the conveniences that they wanted. And in the months that were more convenient to him and the places that were more convenient in his mind. It wasn't a total abandonment of Jehovah. It was reducing the worship and what God expected to their expectations instead of following his word. And all of the kings of the northern kingdom are evil. Every single one of them. There isn't one good one. And they all lead the people away from God instead of back to God. And so in 722, the Assyrians swoop down on them and take them captive. They're done. Solomon's sin results in a divided kingdom, but God still preserves a remnant. In 1 Kings 11:36, he said, I'll give one tribe to his son, to Solomon's son, so that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, a remnant. It gets pretty thin at times, that line between the promise of Genesis 3:15 and its fulfillment in Christ. It's just terrifyingly thin at times, but it never goes out. It never stops. It's never cut off. The southern kingdom has 20 kings. It lasts a little longer, 350 years. Unfortunately, like the northern kings, most of the southern kings lead the people away from God instead of back to him as well, with the exception of four good kings. All of the southern kings trace their ancestry back to David, And in fact, they form an unbroken connection to David. And that's important with respect to Jesus' ancestry as the seed of the woman, which will come through Abraham and David. Matthew 1:1 says that he's giving a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, and traces him back through that line. Luke 3, starting at verse 23, gives more detail and traces Jesus all the way back to Adam, and it includes Abraham and David in that line. So there's that thread, that connection between Jesus all the way back to Genesis 3:15 through David. So it's very important that that line does not break. But sadly, Israel, after this, never becomes much more than a sore spot or an irritant, if you will, in world affairs again, kind of like today. Now, here's a big question. How did a people who had received such a distinguished honor from God, that is to be the bearers of the restorer of the world, how on earth did they get there? Well, let's go back to the beginning and reconnect with God's story to see. And in this part of the history, in this part of the story, it really gets difficult to track it, to follow it, because we tend to lose it in all the details and the people that are involved. Now, I put in your notes the timeline that Noah developed, and but I don't call it a timeline. I call it more of a storyline, because I'm not really too concerned about the chronology of the story as the story itself and what God is doing. But that'll fill in a little more detail. But since it tends to be more visual, I'm going to follow the graphic from this series that we've been using, and we can follow it visually. It helps me anyway. And one of the things that we're going to see, I hope you see anyway, that we're going to start connecting some more of the dots today, because I want to connect it to the whole story. And so back to Genesis we go, and Adam and Eve. Now remember, Adam and Eve are given everything that God had created to oversee it, but also to enjoy. Everything. They enjoy an absolutely fulfilled human life that is purposeful and meaningful. They are to multiply, to fill, cultivate the earth. In other words, they are to be actively involved with God in developing His creation. They have purpose, they have meaning, they have everything they need, everything they could imagine. That is the perfect human life. There was only one thing that was withheld from them, and that was the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, Satan, in Genesis chapter 3, comes to them and convinces them that they're missing out on something that they need to be complete. Yeah, you got the perfect life, almost. But there's that one thing, that if you just had that one thing, it would be all complete and together. You know what? That, I think, is the theme song of our problems. And the thing that most often leads us away from God. And so they bite. And instead of being whole and naked and unashamed, now they are very aware of their nakedness. They are very ashamed. They are guilty. And God covers their nakedness. He remedies that. And He promises to send someone to redeem the mess and restore creation. Genesis 3:15. Is that promise. And that, folks, is the key storyline of the scriptures. A person, the seed of the woman, is coming who will restore God's creation, both what we call the natural world and humanity, back to its original condition and design. And that is where everything in the scriptures and human history is going, to the restoration of God's creation. Well, the fall marked the corruption of the human race, and it didn't take long until the earth was filled with violence and abuse and corruption to the extent that God decides to destroy the earth and everything in it with a great flood. But He spares Noah and his family, and in sparing them, he spares the line of humanity that will produce the seed who would bring complete restoration and redemption to the world. And just for your information, that is called the Noahic Covenant by Bible scholars. Now remember, this counter-kingdom that we see in the northern kingdom is also a threat to that line. The line becomes very thin again, just like it did with Noah. It's almost obliterated because of their disobedience and God's disfavor on them. But even in this, as bad as it got, notice that God does not rescind his value of us or our value to him in helping him or working with him to develop the creation. We are still told to fill, multiply, and cultivate. We're still engaged in the process. He hasn't totally written us off. When we come to the Tower of Babel, that's an interesting thing because it really is a picture of misdirected humanity. And I think it's really important. It's helped me so much to get connected with what it means to be human and how important that is. And God has gifted everyone with the ability to contribute something meaningful to God's creation and to the societies that mankind was building. But instead of participating with God, the people of Babel chose to compete against him by perverting his gifts to make a name for themselves instead of doing everything that they did to honor him. And so God forces them to scatter by mixing up their languages. Cultures continue and nations continue to develop. God hasn't given up on his promise to restore his creation yet. And so God enters into a contractual agreement with a man named Abraham. And in doing that, he narrows the possibilities from which the seed would come. That's known as the Abrahamic covenant. And Abraham becomes the father of Isaac. And Isaac becomes the father of Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons that become the nation Israel. And they're the ones that have this high calling, and what a high calling it is to be the people through whom God would bring the restorer, the redeemer of the world, and he would come through you to the world to do that work. You should have been proud and motivated, wouldn't you think? But they're not. Instead, you see jealousy and fighting with one another. And so Joseph's other brothers, Benjamin was the baby of the family, so the other, let's see, 10, would, in a fit of jealousy, sell him into slavery. And so instead of being a nation, the nation through whom all the nations in the world would be blessed, they become a nation of slaves. After 400 years in Egypt, God calls another man, Moses, out of obscurity to lead the people to freedom. And through Moses, he gives them law to govern them. He gives them written communication from God and a prescribed system of worship. We know that as the Mosaic Covenant. And he gives them a constant reminder of his presence and his involvement with them and their future in the tabernacle. They can see that there. And in all this, he gives them a glimpse into his heart and a constant reminder of his presence with them. Well, Moses begins the journey, but it's Joshua who leads them to the land that was promised to Abraham as a homeland and presumably as a place where the seed of the woman would be born. And Joshua is the one that's given the task to go in, lead the people in, and conquer the land, take it back. Well, you'd think they're getting on track again, wouldn't you? Well, you'd be wrong if that's what you thought. After Joshua dies, sadly, the people forget who God is. They forget what he's done for them. They forget what he's promised to them. And they forget what he's promised to do in the world through them. And so they become a nation of lawlessness and chaos. The period of the judges is characterized by lost faith, punctuated by periods of half-hearted returning to God. Samuel comes on the scene about that time. He's the last of those judges. There's no king in Israel. God rules Israel. God is their king, and he gives direction to them through Samuel. He's not only is Samuel one of the judges, he is also a priest to represent the people before God. He is also a prophet to speak to the people on God's behalf. Here's the key. God is their king. Samuel is his spokesman. But just like back in the Garden of Eden, as the man and woman face that tree, these people think they're missing out on something essential for a complete life. They need a king so they can be just like everybody else around them. Dan did a great job explaining that last week, so check out his message on the internet. So the Israelites... reject God as their king and demand a human king like everybody else. And so they get Saul. On the surface, looks good. But remember, just as God had warned Adam and Eve in Genesis 2, you are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die. Remember, he warned them about that. Well, it's a little wordier, but he also warns the people about their foolishness in demanding a king. He says, this is what the king who will reign over you will do. He'll take your sons and make them serve as chariots and horses, and they will run in front of him as chariots. He'll institute a draft. He will assign some to be commanders of thousands, commanders of fifties, others to plow his ground, reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He'll put you into forced labor. He'll take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants through the law of eminent domain. He'll take a tenth of your grain, of your vintage, and give it to his officials and attendants, your maidservants, manservants, the best of your cattle and donkeys, who will take for his own use. He'll take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. He will institute a tax system. He'll create the IRS. And when that day comes, you'll cry out for relief from the king that you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day. Sorry. Do you see the similarity between that warning and Genesis? You know, I know you think you're missing something, but that something's going to kill you if I give it to you. Now, here's a big question. Had they been left with no leadership? No. Through Moses, God had spoken to them and given them his written word. They had direction for every facet of life under Moses. In addition to that, Moses represented the people before God, and he appointed other leaders like a court system to help the people resolve their disputes with one another. God had produced throughout their history men like Samuel and Joshua and the judges whenever they needed a visible leader to rally the people against a common enemy. When they needed it, they had it. And you know what? They never lost a battle for want of a king. They had even routed enemy forces many times larger than themselves with a little more than trumpets and lanterns under the leadership of Gideon, who God raised up for that special occasion. You see, God was there, and he was active on their behalf all the time. Problem was, they were clueless about it because it didn't seem to fit their idea about how that should look. Well, David then comes along, and the promise of the Redeemer is now even narrowed further down, this time to a specific family within the nation Israel. Ironically, the seed of the woman that we're waiting for to restore things will also be a king out of the ancestry of David. And so God makes another covenant between himself and a man. We call this the Davidic covenant. You can read about it in 2 Samuel 7. The essence of that promise is verse 16. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. Solomon becomes king after David's death. And under Solomon's administration, the kingdom reaches its apex. Solomon accumulates unbelievable wealth, land, and prestige in the world. 1 Kings 10, verses 14 through 28 describes it. He says, the weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly was 25 tons, not including the revenues from merchants and traders and from all the Arabian kings and governors of the land. King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 7.5 pounds of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 small shields of hammered gold, 3.75 pounds of gold in each shield. And he put them in the palace of the forest of Lebanon. Then the king made a great throne inlaid with ivory and overlaid with fine gold. The throne had 6 steps and its back had a rounded top. Both sides of the seat were armrests with lions standing beside each of them. 12 lions stood on the 6 steps, one at the other end, one at either end of each step. Nothing like it had ever been made for any other kingdom. All King Solomon's goblets were gold. All the household articles of the palace, the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Now get this, nothing was made of silver. Why? Well, because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's day. Just silver. The king had a fleet of trading ships at sea, along with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years, they returned carrying gold, silver, ivory, and apes and baboons. King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. Year after year, everyone who came brought a gift: articles of silver, gold, robes, weapons, spices, horses, and mules. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills. Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and from Kew. The royal merchants purchased them from Kew. They imported a chariot from Egypt for 15 pounds of silver and a horse for 3¾ pounds. They also exported them all to the kings of the Hittites and the Arameans. However, Solomon loved many foreign women. Now, I know that we've been over this story repeatedly the past few months, and I think we're going to need to revisit many more times before we're done here. It's essential that we get the story clearly fixed in our minds so that we can interpret our world and make decisions that are consistent with God's thinking and where he's going in the future. Besides that, there are some very valuable lessons to take away from this story. Number one is the need for authenticity. One of the core values at Sierra is authentic spirituality. That's what we call it. We are committed to knowing God, not playing church. The need for authenticity is one of the distinctives that really should characterize the people of God at any time in history. Now, let me explain. We were designed to be what I have started calling normal human beings. Normal in the sense that we do not divide life into special classes, some that are spiritual and some that are secular. Everything we do is to be done to honor God with the abilities he's given us, follow his directions and instructions for life, and then let him determine the outcomes. Contrast that with the attitude and the motivations at the Tower of Babel. But it seems to me that we, the Christian community, have made normal the embracing of religiosity instead of authenticity. Two passages will illustrate what I'm talking about. The first one is up there on your screen, Joshua 7, 1 through 6. Remember, after the Battle of Jericho and that great victory, a huge city, a big battle, and Israelites win it hands down. Why? Because God is their king, and he's leading things. And so after that, the next town on the way in is Ai. Small town, no big deal. Joshua sends out some guys to check it out, do a little recon on it. And they come back and say, oh, this is simple. You know, this is nothing. Just send 2,000 or 3,000 men and let the rest of the people, rest. And, well, it'd be history. Well, they go out to that battle and, man, they are whooped big time by this lesser force. 36 of them are killed. Key here is Joshua's reaction. Verse 6, Joshua tore his clothes and fell face down to the ground before the ark of the Lord after he hears about this loss. And he remained there until evening. The elders of Israel did the same thing and sprinkled dust on their heads. They are sitting there in abject repentance. The ark was the thing. He falls down before the ark because the ark was the thing that God used to show the people that he was with them. And it was where God was. And so Joshua and the elders of Israel prostrate themselves in humility to find out why God is angry with them. Now, contrast that with 1 Samuel 4, verses 1 through 3. Now the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines. The Israelites camped at Ebenezer and the Philistines at Aphek. The Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel. As the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. When the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel asked, "Why did the Lord bring defeat upon us today before the Philistines?" Now listen to this. Let's bring the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Shiloh so that it may go out with us and save us from the hand of our enemies. Now, it's a subtle difference here, but the Ark in the second passage is more valued as a religious icon than God himself is. And instead of falling before the Ark and searching their souls, what is going on here? They drag it out onto the battlefield like a good luck charm in the mistaken hope that it will turn the tide on their behalf. Had they followed Joshua's example, they might have learned that their defeat was because their two priests, Hophni and Phinehas, were thoroughly corrupt. You know, we are engaged in religiosity when we say things like, "Man, I'm tired of wasting my life doing," you can fill in the blank, you know, "laying bricks, building houses, painting, selling cars, bagging groceries, etc., etc., you know, whatever it might be. I want to quit that secular job and get on a church staff so I can serve God." That's not authenticity. That is religiosity. And that is totally mistaken. We're engaged in religiosity when we demand that the next experience be more spiritual than the last one, or that the next church service be more moving than the one before. We're engaged in religiosity when we believe the hype that we heard a few years ago. The passion of the Christ is the greatest evangelism tool in 2,000 years. Bull. Being real with God and with one another is the greatest evangelism tool. We are engaged in spiritual authenticity when we recognize that every ability, every skill that we have are gifts from God, and then we use them to bring honor to Him. Second quality we need to cultivate is humility. It's a personal trait that I think will keep us on track with God. You know, David has his moments. He was certainly anything but pure as the driven snow. But even with all his faults, I think he maintained a certain level of humility. I don't think he ever forgot his humble beginnings from which he came, a shepherd. And many of his psalms seem to bear that out, that he remembers those days. But Solomon, on the other hand, was royalty all his life. He was born and raised in the palace, and I think it jaded him. I think he had a sense of entitlement. "Well, of course, I'm entitled to all of this. I'm Solomon, David's son. I'm the king." I say that because the difference between him and his father when they're confronted by their sin. When David is confronted by his sin, he owns up to it, man, and he repents. And Solomon seems to discount its seriousness. If you look in 1 Kings 11, starting in verse 9, "The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow the gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, 'Since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant, my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates.'" Now, if that was David hearing that message, he would have been on his face. Solomon doesn't seem to be shaken up by it too much. See, here's the thing. Humility can escape us if we forget who we really are and begin to think more highly of ourselves than we ought. Thomas Paine quoted extensively from 1 Samuel 8 and Judges 8 when he formulated his argument against establishing an American monarchy in his pamphlet, Common Sense. I love the statement that he makes in there. He says, "Men who look upon themselves born to reign and others to obey soon grow insolent." In other words, well, you know, I was born to rule you and you were born to obey me. They become insolent. Selected from the rest of mankind, their minds are early poisoned by importance. In other words, don't start believing your press clippings. It will be your ruin. That's closely related to the next quality we need to develop, and that is loyalty to God. You know, almost every king that ruled Israel and Judah had issues with loyalty, except David. Solomon is drawn into idolatry away from God by his wives. Jeroboam, for him, it was politically expedient to lead the people away from God and his prescribed place of worship. Remember, he had the two calves and two places of worship, both ends of his kingdom. Rehoboam, one another of Solomon's sons, led the people of the southern kingdom into idolatry also. His administration is really illustrative of the decline of the nation. 1 Kings 14, 25 through 28 tells us that the temple Solomon built was raided by Shishak, king of Egypt, and all the gold shields that we just read about a minute ago were stolen. And so Rehoboam replaces them with bronze shields. You know what that means? The kingdom is bankrupt. Under Solomon, silver wasn't worth very much. Now, they're replacing the gold with bronze. But again, David, with all his faults, stays loyal to God. And I believe that's what God has in mind when he calls David a man after his own heart. It's not so much that David's heart is perfectly patterned after God's, but that David didn't go after false gods, but instead pursued God loyally and exclusively. Now think about this. Throughout the entire history of Israel and Judah, there were only five kings who were relentlessly loyal to God. 43 kings over a period of 250 to 300 years, and only five are loyal to God. Asa, or David, of course, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah, and Josiah. Now, interesting factoids about these four, besides David. They're all related to David, and they rule in Judah. They're part of that unbroken line between Genesis 3:15 and Jesus. They are all said to have followed David's example. I think that's talking about his example of his loyalty and devotion to God. Now get this. They all, every one of those four, have godly mothers specifically listed with them. Isn't that interesting? See, I think the significance is this, is even though their fathers were dirtbags, their mothers were the ones who had a profound impact on their faith. So moms, your work matters. Dads, your loyalty to God matters too, to your children and to your children's children. Last of all is the quality of contentment. You know, after God created man, he gave him everything to enjoy except one thing. The fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Mankind wanted for absolutely nothing, but still they reached out and took the only thing that had been pronounced off limits. Following that example, Israel repeatedly clamored for a king. Even after Gideon defeated the Midianites, they want to make him king and his son after him king. The people pressed upon Samuel, give us a king. We got to have a king. Why? Well, I think they had trust issues. They wanted someone or something that they could see to fight for them and make them feel secure. It's what I call the something's missing syndrome. See, the tree looked good. It looked pleasing to the eye. It looked like it was good for food. It looked like it would make one wise. Something was missing. They weren't quite perfect. Everybody else has a king, but we don't. Something's missing. Now think about this. Don't miss this. This kind of hit me in the shower the other morning. That's where I learn the best, is in the shower. Think about this. The something missing was the very thing that set them apart from everything else and everyone else. The prohibition to eat from the tree set man apart as the only creature on earth who could make moral choices. It wasn't a bad thing. It was a badge of honor that they were given this privilege, this right to choose to go against their Creator. Nothing else on earth had that. Israel had no king because the Creator of heaven and earth was their king. A human king was a big step down for them. It was like the empty space in the half full glass. When we start feeling the something missing syndrome hit us, we would do well to stop and do like the old song says, count your blessings. Because we may be longing for empty space. Another thing that really struck me in this study was that no one has all of these qualities completely and without lapses. But you know what I saw? That God seems to be eager to accept and work with however much we do have, even if it's only a little. He'll work with us to develop it and to strengthen us. The main thing seems to be the genuineness of our desire and to grow in our relationship with Him. If we're only pretending, it'll only work on us. It doesn't fool God. So take inventory and take it often. Now let me give you one last closing thought. When Christ returns, the earth will again be ruled by God and also by a man, the man, the God-man, Jesus Christ. Let's pray. I think a fitting way to close is, after David's fashion, to pray that the Lord would be your rock, your fortress, and your deliverer. May God be the rock in whom you take refuge. May He be your shield and the horn of your salvation. May He be your stronghold, your refuge, and your Savior. Amen.